Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minig.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for another episode of Behavior Health Integration. Today, we have two very special guests. They are both from Propel Therapeutics in Sacramento, California. First is Dr. Sophia Piva. She's a board-certified anesthesiologist. Sophia first became interested in ketamine-assisted therapy while she was a resident in anesthesia. She has used ketamine thousands of times to provide anesthesia for many different types of settings. Over time, Sophia became very interested in how ketamine can affect someone's mental health for the better. And then we have Dr. Christopher Fisher. He's a triple board certified child, adult, and forensic psychiatrist. Dr. Fisher first became interested in ketamine-assisted therapy when he realized the limitations that traditional oral antidepressant medications can have in terms of effectiveness and side effects for some patients. In this BHI episode, they'll be discussing the therapeutic treatments they apply at Propel Therapeutics, the different kinds of ketamine-assisted therapy that they apply to their patients. They will also be discussing different types of ketamine news on the public and what that means for the future of ketamine-assisted therapy. I, for one, am truly excited to begin this show. So without further ado, let's begin. Well, Sophia and Christopher, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
We're super happy to be here today and being on your show, Jacob.
Yep. Thanks for the invitation. We're really honored to be able to share a lot of our knowledge about ketamine. Yep.
Now, is it true you're calling from California, right?
We are.
How nice is the weather up there? Or down there, should I say?
It's a beautiful fall day. The leaves are just falling today, and it's just a gorgeous place to be.
Yeah.
So better than freezing Minnesota right now.
Yeah, it's crisp, but it's not freezing yet, but it's definitely not warm. But it's nice. Yeah, it's tolerable.
Do you guys even get snow down there that much?
No, not in Sacramento, but just about 90 minutes up. I mean, we're right next to Tahoe. So yeah, mm-hmm. They get dumped on occasionally. I mean, not occasionally, pretty frequently.
Okay, excellent. Well, right off the bat, what made you want to get into your fields of, we'll call it the medical side, the mental health side? How'd that go about in each of your careers?
For myself, you know, when I was a little girl, I've always kind of idolized doctors. And I think part of that was because when I was little, I was frequently having a lot of infections. So I remember having to visit my doctor a lot and creating that relationship with them and really looking up to them. So that is kind of what drove me. And then as I was, you know, getting older and always my goal was to go to medical school, but actually initially I was going to be a surgeon. Ooh. And once I got to medical school and really kind of figured out what I'm really wanting to do and what really fits well with my personality, I made a decision halfway through medical school to switch into anesthesia. And so basically that is what I ended up doing for my residency at USC. And honestly, I think it was the best decision I've ever made. I really love what I do. I really enjoy working in the space that I work in. And I think it was the right decision for me.
Excellent. Christopher?
Yep. So for me, actually, I first became interested in going to medical school during high school. Mm-hmm. I was in San Francisco and there was a program over at UCSF that was called a mini medical school. It was basically a place where you could go and learn more about medicine, and it was more of a general interest place. Mm-hmm. I think that was the only high school student there. Everyone else there was probably age 60 and above. Uh-huh. But I made some connections there and learned a lot of things that really triggered my thoughts about medicine as a career. And then I also wanted to do something that where I could really help people, and combining those two it really drove me to medicine. What's interesting actually was I also was interested in becoming a surgeon initially.
Wow.
Going into medicine. And it took me maybe a few weeks into medical school that I realized that's totally not for me. Yeah, well,
rotations, right? So usually people figure out rotations, what they like and what they don't like.
Yep. So this was actually probably even prior to the rotation, seeing the classes above me and seeing what they're doing. And I realized that doing surgery just was not for me. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to go into a field where I could be really connected with my patients and develop a long-term relationship and understanding and see them really flourish and change their lives. So I liked that long-term relationship. I think going into psychiatry in particular, I had a lot of friends and family that has struggled with mental health issues. And so I had a lot of background knowledge and understanding about that process. So I really kind of leaned into that experience and brought that into to my work. Then I went into particular specialties within psychiatry. So I ended up doing a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry. So I started to really understand things such as trauma and development in terms of people's experiences later on in life. I also then did a fellowship in forensic psychiatry. So I was able to also learn about the different med legal aspects and understanding of psychiatry in relationship to other fields, not just medicine. So that's really what brought me into to mental health.
And I'm sure, did you two see a lot of mental health issues amongst your fellow students in med school, like burnout, stress, anxiety? Was it pretty common?
Absolutely. So medicine as a field, and I think this might be changing, is very rigorous and can be quite stressful on people's mental health. So rates of suicide, rates of depression are much higher within the medicine field, and particularly within medical school, because you are basically taking people that are going from really high stress situations where they've, you know, they have to get an A on an exam in order to get into medical school. You have to get a certain GPA. You have to get a certain MCAT score. You have to have all these extracurricular activities. That's a lot of pressure on students. That really can put a big stressor on, particularly in someone that's in their early 20s. Oftentimes when we see depression or anxiety disorders start to really develop. So that those rates, those prevalences is much higher. Now, the good thing is within medical schools, I think they're really looking at this and finding ways to decrease that stress, increase camaraderie, decrease the competition, and increase cooperation, and particularly having special programs to address mental health within the medicine field and as well as within medical school itself.
Anything to add to that, Sophia? Your experience?
No, I really echo what your thoughts are on this. You really take a lot of very high functioning individuals that are used to, you know, having a lot of success when they come in from undergraduate. And now you place all those top high earners into a class and now they have to compete with each other. And that is one of the biggest problems I see with medical schools is that instead of corroborating with each other, we are forced to basically compete with each other. So if I am to do well, then I need someone else to do worse. And this is kind of the mentality. And I think that's what drives a lot of these burnouts and the like developing of loneliness, because a lot of the time you see individuals and students in medical school that they don't want to share their notes. They don't want to share their insights. Yeah. They don't want to share anything because they feel that if I give you what I know, then you will get a better score than me. Then therefore you will get a better residency than me. And so, but I think this is all changing because now instead of giving grades in classes in medical school, they're just making it a pass fail. So that definitely brings down the pressure to perform or to have to beat out other people in order to be the top performer. And I think that's really a healthy way to move in the future, because honestly, right now, our country, we are very low on physicians. It's very hard to find physicians and train them. And so I think that we need to change our approach if we want to attract more people into the medical field in the future, because it's a very rigorous process and not a lot of people, one, can handle getting through it, and two, are willing to, because it's not just the rigor, but it's also a lot of student loans. I mean, I came out of medical school with $360,000 of student loans, of which $150,000 of that was actually just the interest. So you can imagine it's not just the high number of loan, but also the lending practices are terrible. They have very high interest rates, and those loans, they compound several times while you're still in training, while you're only earning, you know, $50,000 a year. So I think that if we are looking to make our system a little bit more, I guess, better, or, you know, looking to kind of get a little bit more physicians willing to go through the training, we need to actually look towards the way it's done in Europe and other countries, because I feel it's a lot better there. And it's better for everyone, because when you coordinate and you cooperate with others, this is how you get more knowledge, and this is how you solve really big problems, because you can't really do that as a single man. You really need a whole village to help you with some of these bigger health issues.
Do you think it's more of making med school not more easy, but more like student friendly when you're in med school, rather than just making it easier to get to med school to obtain more physicians?
That's a really interesting question.
Because you said there's a low number, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of people trying to get into medical school.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And, you know, that's great, because we all know the competition basically results in getting the best of the best. I think that perhaps we have too few medical school spots. I think perhaps increasing that number a little bit to meet the demand, because let's face it, we are increasing our population as time goes by. So it only makes sense that we would need more physicians. But the other problem is that we have an aging population. So as time goes on, more and more bigger percentage of our population is going to need medical services. And some of them are going to need some really serious medical services, like really big operations or really complex type of medical interventions. So I think perhaps increasing the number of spots in medical school, I think the competition to get to medical school is great. I wouldn't change that. But I think once you get in, you've kind of proven yourself. You're obviously one of the best out there. And so at that point, I think it should be more of a cooperative type of environment where you guys all grow and learn from each other and become the best that you can.
Basically looking at things from a team perspective. So once you get a medical school, at least when I was in medical school, it was very much individual. Okay, you have to get this done on your individual level. You have to pass these exams. I think looking at more from a team perspective, and I think this has certainly changed significantly since I was in medical school, looking at more of the case-based learning instead of, you know, memorize these facts. And this extends all the way through residency and fellowship as well. You know, a lot of residents get burned out. You know, I personally, I knew that at certain parts of my time in residency, there was burnout, for sure. And finding ways to get through that, to have your team work together and really support each other. And that's happened to me too. You know, during residency, there's been times where I've met with, let's say, my chief resident, and finding ways to work as a team and to do better and find ways to support each other.
And I don't know how you guys do it. I mean, I don't know. How many hours are you putting in a week in residency? 60 at minimum? 50, 60 at least? Tough question.
I think it really depends on the specialty that you choose. If you're in a surgical specialty, you're likely pushing 80 hours a week, which is a lot, because a lot of it has to do with doing long hours without sleep.
Yep.
I think in anesthesia, I think it might be getting a little better there, but we were definitely pushing 60 hours or more. I don't know about how psychiatry is. I think you guys are easier, no?
Yep. So the first year is very similar to other residencies. It's almost like your intern year. Once you get past that, second year, a little bit lighter, and then third and fourth year is much lighter as you start to do more rotations within fields that you're, you know, particular subspecialties you might be interested in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Dermatology is the easiest. I know that for sure. Well, because I used to have friends in dermatology. They used to brag about how they didn't have to be on at work on weekends, and they didn't have call. And
do any of you watch Grey's Anatomy?
Yeah, I've watched
those. There was an episode about dermatology where they go to the dermatologist's office. They're like, oh my God, it's so nice here. It's amazing. They have fruit, they have wonderful music.
Yeah, part of it is because there are not a lot of emergencies in that field. So that's kind of what drives a lot of these long hours, is because there's a lot of work. When there's a lot of urgent and emergent things you have to take care of in your field, you know, it opens up a lot of work. And in dermatology, there isn't really much. There's maybe a couple of skin conditions that really need to be taken care of right away, but they're so extremely rare that most students or residents will likely not even see a single case during their residency. So that's, you know, that's how rare it is.
So now I want to get to the magic topic of ketamine. And since you two both come from different fields, I'm sure you had different viewpoints or different experiences on how you first got exposed to ketamine related therapy. Would you mind telling me each of your stories?
Yeah, of course. So I first got exposed to ketamine in my residency program at USC, University of Southern California. The program there was very, I would say, heavy on ketamine education. I think people were really enthralled with that medicine. And I've noticed that after I went out to private practice, a lot of the practitioners around me, a lot of the anesthesiologists were not as excited about ketamine. A lot of them hadn't used it since residency. And so I found myself to be the only one that would use it, you know, more frequently. And so I think that's basically how I got introduced to it. And I think that learning a lot about it, using it all the time in residency, I think I became really comfortable with it. And also going through a really rigorous residency helped as well, because I got to see a lot of things and learn a lot from that. So when I first came out, I was in private practice, and honestly, it was really brutal. I was working, you know, 60, 70 hours a week. Sure, I was getting paid a lot of money, but again, at some point, the cost of getting an extra dollar is not worth the time you have to put into it. So I actually ended up getting burned out from that. And I went into, I would say, like a mini depression phase myself, where I wasn't sleeping well at night. I was, you know, emotionally labile. I obviously had a lot of stress hormones, and my hormones were imbalanced. I ended up gaining a ton of weight. And basically, I was not functioning, you know, at my optimum. So this is kind of when I started exploring more, doing something different. And ketamine, of course, since I was so familiar with it, came to the limelight right away. And basically, I went up to Dr. Fisher here and I was like, hey, why don't we start a ketamine infusion clinic? And that's kind of how the idea was born. And then basically, it was a lot of me sitting down and figuring out how to do it, reading through a lot of research papers that I could find online and through the sources that I had, reaching out to individuals that were already running ketamine clinics and trying to learn from them. And that's kind of how we got it started. Yeah.
Now, what was ketamine originally used for? Because it's for pain management, right? To an extent and other things, but...
So that's a really great question. So ketamine was initially created for veterinary medicine. Yep. Before ketamine, there was another medication called PCP. This medication is known as by another name called angel dust, and it actually binds to the exact same receptor as ketamine. And the problem with that medication when it was used in veterinary care is that it had a lot of side effects. And so what happened was, in order to replace that medication with something, ketamine was synthesized. And there's, I think, a little bit of question about the exact year that it was synthesized. I've read a lot of different sources. Some say 68, some say 69. And there's also 1970, which I think is when it got the FDA approval. But basically, ketamine bounds to the same receptors. It's extremely safe. It has a very, you know, low side effects. So that's what kind of, you know, replaced that PCP in veterinary care. And then later on, just like a lot of other medications that we have, they started out being tested on animals, of course. But later on, it became, you know, approved for human use. And then it was used in the Vietnam War very extensively as a really great anesthetic for the battlefield.
Oh.
Because ketamine has a lot of different, very interesting properties. One is, yes, it has this dissociative property, which is what, you know, helps with the pain control. Basically, you cut off the signal between the pain stimulus and your brain, so you dissociate from the pain. Two, it can cause some amnesia. Three, at high doses, it could really make you stay still. So you don't want to move. And that can be helpful on the battlefield if you have to do some kind of minor procedure or, you know, kind of take care of somebody. You don't want them flailing around. And then another thing is it kind of doesn't make you want to talk. So at high doses, you kind of want to stay quiet. You want to stay still. And it has some hallucinogenic properties. Anesthetic doses, of course, we use it for inductions, basically to put you to sleep for general anesthetic or to maintain your anesthetic. In more recent history, though, it's mainly used in children. It is so extremely safe that we choose to preferentially use it in small children. And part of the reason for that is because it doesn't cause apnea. And apnea is when you stop breathing. So when I give you enough opioids, you are not going to want to breathe anymore. Yep. So ketamine actually doesn't do that. It actually helps with continuing you to breathe despite you being anesthetized. Another positive of being used in the battlefield, because there you can't have all these equipment getting carried around, you know, that's heavy, big oxygen tanks, all that stuff is very heavy. And it's also why it's good for children, because children have very low reserve. I mean, just imagine, they're not really a smaller version of us, but all of their, you know, body parts are smaller. Their airways are narrower, you know, a smaller amount of inflammation in their airway can cause a huge problem.
Yeah.
So for that reason, ketamine is now preferably used in children. But in the last 10 years or so, we've discovered that low doses, or what we call sub-anesthetic doses, are something that can really help with mental health and can be a very fast, basically, not a cure, I would say, but it could alleviate depressive symptoms. Mm-hmm. It could alleviate suicide ideations. And I think that the word is still out on how it does that. I mean, there's several theories about it, but.
Do you feel there's still a lot of negative stigma? Because it was used as a party drug for a little bit, right? In our society. Special K, maybe he was called.
Yeah, Special K.
Yeah.
Used in the 90s and 2000s as a party drug, you know, along with the other psychedelics. Yeah. I mean, LSD, ecstasy. So I think it does. And a lot of the people that call our clinic to get more information, I do hear a lot of that. Oh, is this a medicine to tranquilize horses? I'm really scared to do this because, you know, it's like a drug and I have to talk to some other people like my parents because they don't approve. So yeah, there is still a lot of negative stigma. And I think that part of that might be, you know, the press, because the press, the way they word certain articles, you know, they present it like that to the general public, and the general public doesn't know or has enough resources to figure it out. I think if we are to make ketamine more of a mainstream type of treatment that's more acceptable, we need to start with the way we talk about it. And I think that, in fact, I don't think we should refer to it as a drug. I think we should refer to it as a medication because, you know, honestly, everything that you put in your body is a quote unquote a drug. I mean, your blood pressure medication, it's a drug, but we don't call it, you know, here's your blood pressure drug. Yeah, we call it, you know, medication. And I think that kind of changing that will help. But I want to hear from Dr. Fisher because he's been quiet for a little while.
So I think a lot of it starts with education. We actually get a lot of people that don't even understand what ketamine is. Mm-hmm. And for them to understand that this is a really viable type of treatment for depression, for anxiety, for bipolar depression, and even for now substance use disorders as well. So it's really, a lot of it is education, helping them understand that this is a treatment that's available to them, and also a treatment that is highly effective. Even if someone has tried multiple other treatments, a lot of times we get calls and they say, you know, doc, I've tried 20 different antidepressants. Well, do you want to try a 21st one? You know, that's, we have to try a different approach. We really need to look at a different approach if the approach we're doing right now isn't working. And these are people that are really at the their limit. A lot of times we get patients that have a lot of suicidal thoughts, and they need a treatment that's going to work, and they need a treatment that's going to work fast. We can't wait 4 to 6 weeks to start to notice a change in your thoughts about suicide if you're having thoughts right now. We need something that's going to work now. And so it really goes back to education. And so we're out in the community talking with therapists, with other psychiatrists. We're going to be doing grand rounds. We're writing news articles and reaching out to people and doing open houses so we can educate the public. And I think that once people get educated about this option, really that opens up their eyes to this as a treatment and really opens up the possibilities that they can get better.
No, I'm really glad you mentioned the antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications, because I've read research, I think it's pretty good anyways, that after the third or fourth antidepressant an individual tries, the chances of them using the next antidepressant to really help their mental health symptoms is like 5%. It's that low at that point.
So that's what's based on a study called the STAR-D study.
Yep.
And this study results is in itself, just reading it is very depressing. It is sad how limited the efficacy is or how effective something is after you tried a couple antidepressants. We really need to start thinking about interventional options after, you know, even after the first, if that's, you know, if someone has had significant side effects, we have to look at what are our additional options for that treatment for that patient, particularly if we need to start working fast on their symptoms. Certainly, if there's some time where we have some mild symptoms and we have time to work with, you know, that might be different. But when we're dealing with major depressive disorder, where this is affecting someone's functioning, affecting their ability to get out of bed, affecting their ability to go to work, take care of someone, we're talking about lives.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you too, do you hear a lot about individuals actually getting addicted to ketamine?
So within our setting, within the clinical setting, that is virtually zero.
Okay.
Yep. So this is, and I talk with, you know, with our patients, people even tell us, you know, I would never do this outside of your setting here. It's so important to have a set and setting. So a set is creating the mindset for your treatment, mm-hmm. being prepared, what we call preparation. And then the setting is a safe environment. You know, place where you're monitored, where we have anesthesiologists if something happens, and nothing has happened in our clinic, but knowing that you're in a safe, you know, safe place. Also, the decoration of the actual room, you know, being intentional in design of a particular clinic is also very important.
Mm-hmm.
Having different things like music. So I curate specific music for the treatments for our patients. That can get them really into the treatment and get them in, really tap into their subconscious to start to work through different issues, whether it's trauma, anxiety, or depression. So we don't get patients that come to us looking at, you know, getting, you know, quote unquote high. These are people that are trying to get back to their normal state. And when it's done in a supervised manner, the risk of addiction is incredibly low.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, like, when I hear studies on people getting addicted to ketamine, Sophia, it's like you said, if you use something enough, like anybody can get addicted to anything, like food, other drugs or whatnot. And again, from what I hear, it's very small. But again, if you use ketamine or anything else, like in a professional setting with medical professionals, that's the best way to do it. Absolutely.
Yeah, so the issues with addiction, these are usually people that are using, you know, large doses or multiple times, not within a particular procedure or protocol. They're going out to parties, not, you know, they're not going inward and learning how to process through things. So it's a very different approach.
You know, I make the same argument too when people are like bad mouthing like psychedelics, LSD, whatever. It's like, yeah, when you use in particular ways, of course, it's going to affect the way you feel regarding your mental health about it. But if you go into the session with the correct dose and the right mindset and goals, that's the way you should do it, you know, with intentions, with good intentions.
Absolutely. Intention is key.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that you brought up food, because let's be real, sugar.
Yes, it is.
Has been shown, you know, with scientific evidence, to be just as addicting as cocaine. Yep. So, you know, all those people out there that are, you know, sugar junkies, yeah, they're, guess what? That's an addiction too, because if something makes you feel good and gives you euphoria, yeah, and then if that something makes you go through a withdrawal, like the big crash that you get, yep, after you're on a sugar high, mm-hmm, guess what? That is addiction, because that has all the components that identifies addiction. So I think I agree with Dr. Fisher on this one. If it's used in the right way, in the right setting, then I think that the chance of addiction are virtually zero. And I've actually never had any patient come up to us and say, oh, I really wish I could do this at home. In fact, I have had the exact opposite. Patients say that, you know what, I don't ever feel like I want to do this outside of this clinic. So
I got a question. What, hypothetically, what would you two do if you had an individual come to your clinic and said, yeah, I did have a previous addiction to ketamine. Would you still possibly take that patient, or would there be other things you'd consider?
That's a really good question. You know, I think that we'd have to really look at what the issue was at the time when they were addicted to the ketamine. You know, what did they actually kind of meet, you know, criteria for dependence, for a use disorder, as we now call it? And what were they, you know, what kind of hole were they trying to fill at the time? You know, oftentimes we think of addiction as, you know, stemming from trauma, and looking at what, you know, what was driving it at the time. Is that still present? Is that something we need to address? I think it's not going to be a yes, no answer. Mm-hmm. We really have to look at each individual, and that's really what we do in our clinic. You know, if someone comes to us with issues of addiction, is looking at the patient, not just as a, you know, checkbox here or there, but really looking at them from a biopsychosocial model and understanding, you know, the person that you are now may be very different than the person that you were 10 years ago.
Absolutely. And is that another reason why you guys have therapists too at your clinic?
So the reason why we have a therapist, and I would consider myself included, is that we really need to look at the intentionality of the treatment, mm-hmm, and the preparation work. And we strongly believed when we were creating this clinic that we wanted to create something really special, something that would be really looking at the patient as a whole, but also looking at how can we improve outcomes? How can we improve and also continue more of a long-lasting effect? So we wanted to include both what we consider the gold standard of treatment, which is the intravenous or IV. We are also going to be offering IM as well. But we all, in addition to that, we wanted to have a therapeutic or psychotherapeutic component to it, which includes, you know, which does start at the intake when I do an intake with a patient. We talk about their intention, what their goals are. So instead of talking about, you know, oftentimes we talk about symptoms and reducing symptoms, I flip it on its head and say, what would you like to experience again in your life? You know, maybe something that depression has taken away from you. Maybe something that your PTSD has taken away from you. What is something positive that you'd like to gain again? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes people say peace, you know, calm, some joy, some happiness. These are things people have lost. So starting that process, that therapeutic process, is really from the very first get-go. Then once they come to our clinic, we again go over their intentions or their intention with the treatment. We don't do talk therapy during an infusion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would not be helpful. I think that at that point, patients really need to go inward, to do an inward journey, to start to learn how to process emotions and process trauma. But we do it right after they get a short period of recovery, and when, mm-hmm, they can start to discuss things with us, because a lot of these things actually fade with time. A lot of the images may fade with time. So we like to do integrative work right after, And then we supplement that, or we add to that significantly as well with group integration work. So once a week, we have a fantastic therapist who does group integration work for our patients. So it's a really comprehensive type of treatment that we're looking at. And when I'm looking at individual outcomes, I found that those people that come to us that do are able to open up and process things that they've seen or experienced during their journeys, and that really do the integrative steps between infusions, that they really do the best.
May I ask, how long is a session? Well, let's say when they do like the IV treatment and they're sitting there, is it usually like half an hour, an hour? How does that work?
So the infusion itself lasts for about an hour.
Okay.
Someone that comes to our clinic, they're going to be here for about 2 hours. So when we're including all of the preparation beforehand and the integration afterwards, each person comes in for about 2 hours.
So they do that and they meet with a therapist for an hour, like right after the infusion?
So we do about 15, 20 minutes before preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, we're doing about 30 minutes of integration work. And that's with either myself, the psychiatrist, or we actually also have another psychiatrist who's also trained in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. So that's with each infusion. So with each infusion, a patient meets with a psychiatrist each time they come in. And then they also once a week get 90 minutes of group integration therapy. So that is all included with the treatment.
Excellent. Yeah, now that I think about it, because I would love to ask you more about what your pre-admission steps are, because I know with psychedelics, that could be like ayahuasca, MDMA, or whatnot, they require you to be off all medications, where ketamine, and as physicians, you're fine with them being on particular medications, let's say like Adderall or any other or another antidepressant, right?
Yep. So each person that comes to us will have an intake with myself, and we'll go through all of their psychiatric history, all of their medications, their social history, family history. So we do a very comprehensive intake process. With their medications, getting to your specific question, so I'm able to review their medications, understand them, and talk about potential interactions, if any. There's really no interactions. There are some medications that may decrease the effectiveness of ketamine, and we can go through those individually with the patient and talk about them, whether we want to do any kind of reduction at all, or to do maybe one day off of a particular medication. But that's what's great about having that intake with myself, so we can have a really in-depth discussion regarding that. I also like to really reach out and work with their prescribing psychiatrist or their therapist and have that discussion as well, because it's a team. I consider ourselves as working with the team of other therapists and their psychiatrist, or oftentimes people get mental health through the primary care doctor. So I think of us as more of the interventionalists. So someone may come to us for particular needs. We can address those needs and they can continue with their therapy with their therapist.
I have a juicy question. Have you two ever worked with another patient's provider or physician, and their physician's like, no, I don't approve my patient for ketamine therapy? And if so, how do you get around that?
Yep. So we haven't had that come up, but we've had something similar come up. Really interesting. So a patient recently told us that their primary care doctor was really skeptical about them getting ketamine therapy. But the patient was really interested in getting this treatment and sought it out on her own. And so she came to us and she did great. She did really wonderful results and really long lasting results too. And she goes back to her primary care doctor, and her primary care doctor is now educated on this treatment.
Okay.
And really wants to know more about it. That is beautiful. That is wonderful when we can start to show the results and start to educate other providers in the area.
So in a respectful way, it's appropriate to interact with other physicians, but at the end of the day, you don't really need to. Is that from a legal sense?
So I like to reach out to as many people as I can.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times it's just the results that people see. So, mm-hmm. and that goes also with other family members. So, you know, someone may come back from, you know, maybe going to Thanksgiving, you know, maybe someone from our clinic is going to Thanksgiving with their families. Those other family members start to say, you know, this person looks different. You know, what's going on? What's changed? Yep. What are you doing? And word starts to spread.
Excellent. So when did your organization actually start? I'm just curious about therapeutics.
Oh, around April of 2020.
Okay, excellent. So you guys are still new, growing, and I sense a lot of big things from you. And actually, I want to ask another question too. You know, Sophia, you said you or both of you provide minimal low doses at first. Like, for an example of an adult, what is considered like a low dose? And I'm sure it's based on their size as well, but
that's a really great question. And it's kind of a complex question because it really, we take the full individual into account before we decide on the dosage.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you the factors that we use in order to decide on what that number will be. So we use their weight. We also use their age. We also take mm-hmm. into account what other psychiatric medications they're on. We also take into account whether or not they've had ketamine in the past or whether or not they've had other psychedelic medication treatment in the past. Mm-hmm. And also a bit of it is actually me eyeballing them once I meet them and getting a sense of who they are and what I think they can handle. And I think a big part of that is experience. I have been doing anesthesia for about 10 years. And I mean, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I feel like I do have a good sense of being able to really try to figure out how much somebody needs.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the very first infusion is kind of a discovery process for us and for the patient. And I'm really open and forward with them about that because we do use ranges of dosing, mm-hmm. but again, the first session is really a discovery to see how much can they handle, because some people can handle a higher dose than others. And again, a lot of it has to do with these other points that I made earlier about, you know, their previous experiences with the medication or other medications that they're taking. So yeah, I think, I don't know if Chris has anything to add to that.
I think also low is a relative term. So we're actually, when we're looking at treatment for depression, PTSD, anxiety, you know, pain, these are higher doses than what you would say is just if someone were to take ketamine on an oral basis. You know, being able to deliver it through IV, we can get higher doses and maintain them at cruising altitude mm-hmm. for a much longer period of time. And we can do that in a safe manner. I think when she was talking about low before, we're talking about in comparison to if someone goes into surgery. So that's where the low part comes in, but it's relatively to what we're comparing it to.
Yep. And like you said, some patients will get type of a euphoric type of feeling when they're in session and they'll really be in the zone. Are you looking for anything from the patient when they're like in the midst of their infusion, any type of like body language behaviors, or you just kind of like let it all go?
So this is a great question. So we strongly feel that with these types of experiences, that there's going to be a range of journeys. There's going to be mm-hmm. some that where someone makes, you know, these connections and they feel really more at peace and are able to think things through at a higher perspective or a higher level of consciousness. There's also going to be some journeys that are going to be challenging. And I often tell people, don't be afraid of those.
Yeah.
Those sometimes can be the most revealing or most insightful. And that's so important to be able to process through. So if someone is crying during a session or becomes emotional, that's not a problem. we're making progress. We're here for a reason. They're here for a reason. And being able to sit with that and be able to process through it and talk about it afterwards is so important.
Absolutely. I'm curious. So when you're doing like treatment plans for patients, how often do they get infusions per week and how many months does it go on for?
So our protocol that we have is 6 infusions spaced out once a week. We like this because it allows enough time to start to do the integrative work, to make the behavioral changes. Dr. Pivas oftentimes says it takes about 6 weeks to change a behavior or make a new habit. And so that's actually perfect timing. Mm-hmm. We can make significant changes within someone's life within that period of time. It also allows for that group integration session that we have once a week. For the therapist, for the 90-minute therapy to go through and to process through things and create new goals. So that, we found, has been the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. You go further out than once a week within that induction, we call the induction phase, the first 6, mm-hmm. you lose momentum. Okay. You definitely lose momentum. So we want it at least once a week, ideally once a week, for 6 sessions. After that, it's very much individual-based. We sit down with each person that comes to us, and once we get to that point, if they've responded to the 6 treatments, mm-hmm. is looking at something we call maintenance treatment. And that looks very different for each person that comes to us.
Yeah, I remember someone a while ago said it's not necessarily a quick fix. Then that's why, again, those maintenance treatments look different, where someone might need to come back in a month or 2 months, and just everyone's different.
And Dr. Piva can probably talk a little bit about the protocol for pain, which is a little bit different for us.
Oh, yeah. So the protocol for pain is very different than the protocol for depression and anxiety. The pain protocol involves you being at our clinic for at least 3 to 4 hours for a very long infusion. And those doses are also a lot higher. They're probably almost double the depression doses, and we try to push it as much as we can. The biggest thing that prevents us from, you know, pushing the dose even higher is usually side effects, and the most common thing, it's nausea and vomiting. So, you know, I have a lot of medications, different types of medications for anti-nausea and vomiting that I can give and inject, but sometimes the doses are so high that you cannot overcome that, or you climb. You know, every time they come in, we go up on their dose. So sometimes making those jumps can also cause a lot of nausea. But yeah, the protocols are much longer. They're about, I would say, 3 to 4 hours. And the frequency should be a little bit more higher. So coming in twice, maybe 3 times a week is better. Because with the pain, the idea there is, well, I think one of the hypotheses. So again, we don't know an absolute reason about why it works for pain, but we can hypothesize. Mm-hmm. Basically, the receptor that ketamine blocks is a receptor that modulates glutamine, which is a neurotransmitter. Now, a neurotransmitter is a chemical in our body that the nervous system uses to communicate. So one neuron to the next neuron, they communicate with neurotransmitters, basically small little messengers. Mm-hmm. And so the nervous system has 2 type of messengers. One is an excitatory messenger and one is an inhibitory messenger. The funny part is that our nervous systems have a lot more excitatory neurotransmitters. And so glutamate is one of those very potent, most common excitatory neurotransmitter. Mm-hmm. And now I guess the next question would be, so what does it mean to have an excited nervous system? Well, excitement means a lot more sensitivity, and that means a lot more sensitivity to stimuli. So that will cause more pain. So if I touch you lightly and I touch someone with chronic pain lightly, they might experience that as pain versus you might experience that as pressure. And so, and that is because their nervous system is so excited. It's jumpy. It's, you know, it's hot. And so the idea with ketamine infusions is that you try to decrease this excitatory neurotransmitter in order to kind of calm and make the nervous system fall asleep a little bit, so that it's less jumpy, it's less excited, it doesn't over Yeah, basically it doesn't overreact to the stimuli that you give it. And in order to do this, we have to do this in a very systematic stacking, meaning that you come in several times a week in order to get this medicine so that you continue to block that glutamate, block that glutamate, yeah. block that glutamate. And the other thing about the nervous system is that neurons, they're very finicky. Once you touch a neuron or you mess with it or you agitate it in any way, that neuron could be upset for a really long time. And we're talking months to years.
Wow.
Months to years. So this is why these infusions have to be so close together so that you can really give it a good shutdown for, you know, for as long as possible to kind of get that process of remission going. And those people very likely need infusions more frequently for maintenance until their nervous system becomes more cool, if you will. But that's basically the idea there.
Is that similar to like all pain medications like Vicodin, where it slows down the afferent fibers? Because isn't that pain management in general or pain relief? Is it slows those signals down prior to getting to the brain? And correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's a really great question. And I think that the pain, unfortunately, is a very complex beast.
Subjective.
It's very subjective and it's very complex because unlike what we used to think in the past, now we're realizing the pain is modulated by many different receptors in our nervous system, many, many different kinds. So what we are used to throwing at pain is opioids. Because opioids block the opioid receptor.
Yep.
But guess what? There's about 1,000 other receptors that also modulate pain. So sure, we block the opioid receptor, but there's still all these other receptors that can, transmit pain up to our brains. And so with the Vicodin and the opioids, they basically hit just one little area. And what happens there is the opioids, for example, they'll block the opioid receptor. And so that receptor will not be able to release its neurotransmitters to tell the central nervous system, like, hey, there's something going on down here. There's pain. You need to pay attention to this. Because basically pain is a way for our bodies. It's a mechanism for safety. Because, for example, if you have your hand in a burnt over a hot stove, you want to have pain because that's what tells your brain, like, hey, you're doing something to hurt yourself. You need to address this situation. So, you know, pain is not, it's not bad, but a pain that's out of control is bad. So basically what opioid does is it blocks that signal to go from, you know, your hand to your spinal cord up to your brain. So then that basically process is blocked. But the problem with those medications is that our body is very interesting in this way, but the more we block those receptors, then basically our body upregulates those number of receptors. So after a while, and this is very well, I think, understood, you see when people start taking opioids or pain medicine, after a while, they're like, oh, I'm taking the exact same dose, but it's not working anymore. And it's not working anymore because your body, guess what? Your body just doubled the amount of receptors. So now, so let's just use numbers. Before you had 100, you know, for example, before you had 100 pain receptors, you took some pain medicine, some opioid, and you blocked 90% of that. So 90 of those receptors are blocked. Now, 3 months later, because you're taking this medicine every day, your body made 300 receptors. So now you're only blocking 90 receptors out of your 300. Okay, well, that's only 30%. So that's why your body is able to transmit that pain again. So this is why you're starting to feel pain. So this is why those people, they need more and more and more and more. And this is the problem.
Can ketamine be used to help with that though?
Yes, it can. So ketamine can definitely help with that because ketamine will attack a different part of the pain signaling system. And that is the, NMDA receptor. Am I saying this right? Yeah. NMDA receptors. Yeah. So it uses glutamate and also ketamine is really versatile. It actually binds to other type of pain receptors. It binds to, it helps with, receptors that modulate our, the ephedrines and norepinephrines in our body. So those are like fight or flight kind of things. They increase your blood pressure. They also have a local anesthetic component, and local anesthetic is also a pain receptor. They work through sodium, but basically Ketamine is a very, what's the word I'm looking for? It can bind to many different kind of receptors. It's not very specific. And I think that's why it can hit a lot of different kind of receptors and cause pain relief in those different pathways and kind of spread a wide net, you know, get a lot of them. And it definitely, it also can bind to the opioid receptor. It's really, ketamine is, it's kind of magical in a way. I actually have a CME talk that I do on ketamine and pain. It's called The Magic of Ketamine, because it really is very interesting. And I don't think we quite fully understand why it works. But one of the theories is that because the molecule can bind to all these different type of receptors. This is why when you take the oral ketamine through a lozenge, you start feeling numbness in your mouth. It's because of the local anesthetic property of ketamine.
One thing I want to add to that, I think is super important and really exciting in this field right now, is that it also promotes something called neuroplasticity. Essentially, what this means is that we are creating new connections in the brain. We are promoting what we call synaptogenesis. So those little neurons within your brain, those billions of neurons, we're actually promoting connections between them. And this is important because it helps us be able to make new patterns in our behaviors and new patterns in our thinking. A lot of times with depression or anxiety, we fall into these different cycles of thinking. We can't get out of them. You know, tell someone that has depression, just snap out of it, doesn't work. Right? It's similar like someone that has diabetes, you know, just stop your diabetes. It doesn't work. We need to find new ways to stop that negative thinking, that anxious thinking pattern. And a lot of that is breaking it through this neuroplasticity, which is a really exciting area.
Do you think that's allowing people to get to their subconscious a lot easier now with ketamine, is because of those neural pathways that are being created by the brain, possibly?
So that is one aspect. I think the other aspect too is that with the ketamine itself, we know that there's decreased activation of the amygdala. So the amygdala is the fear center of the brain.
Yep.
We see it goes down, the activation of that. We decrease the activation of the amygdala, which then allows us to start to process things such as trauma. You know, a big issue with PTSD and trauma is avoidance.
Yes.
And so ketamine essentially can let you to start to tap into the subconscious mind. You know, our conscious mind is helpful because it helps protect us, but it can also be an avoidance issue, particularly when there's trauma. And we have to be able to access the subconscious mind and allow it to do its thing. Something we call the inner healing intelligence. This is vital for getting past trauma. Oftentimes we have people that come to us and say, you know what, after infusion, trauma comes up and, you know, different things in their past. And they start to realize, you know what, this is something I haven't processed through. You know, I've gone through years of therapy, you know, taking years of medication. I thought this was, you know, that I had squared this away and I was over this. Well, they're here for a reason. They're here because they have different things that are bothering them. And oftentimes it's linked to these different things that still need healing.
It's because of that mindfulness approach. They don't want to be in tune with their body because they're not ready to experience those uncomfortable emotions and feelings, which, yes, talk therapy can help. It takes a very long time for some individuals to do that because, again, they're so in tune with their body and their emotions. Or don't you think ketamine gives them the ability to be more in tune with their body a little bit quicker, or a lot quicker than actual talk therapy?
It works rapidly.
Yes.
It works rapidly. You know, people that have told me that they've never been able to be mindful, that they've never been able to meditate, now start a new meditation practice. And so we really encourage that between sessions. Start to do these things that you felt that you just couldn't do. And you couldn't. You know, oftentimes their mind is racing and anxiety is taking things away from them. Now they have a window of opportunity to make these changes. And so that's what I tell them. You have a wonderful opportunity to change your life. We have people that come to us, they're in their 70s, your late 70s, that or in early 80s, a couple of patients that have felt, you know, this has been my whole life. I don't think I can ever change. Yeah. And they've changed. That is what is so beautiful about this treatment.
And I can guarantee you right now, if you allow ketamine to be in substance abuse treatments for, we'll just say adults, it will significantly impact their recovery rate. I can almost guarantee it. And I wish that would happen. I really do.
You know, the co-founder of Alcohol Anonymous,
Bill W.
So
there's debate on that. I think I know where you're getting to. You will find so many people, and that's why I said Dr. Mantel last time, that will never admit that. But okay. No, I agree with you. Yes, and it's a beautiful thing, but I'm sorry for interrupting. Please continue.
No, and that's, there's got to be different approaches. Certainly, ketamine isn't for everyone. You have to be ready for the treatment. You have to be ready to make a change in your life. So knowing that is so important.
Yeah.
Having the right mindset going into it is really important.
Hey, in the history of, did Bill W. even admit that he took LSD?
He did.
Did he actually admit it? Okay.
So he wrote a letter to Carl Jung to about this type of treatment and how LSD can really expand the consciousness and be able to tap into that higher power, as he says. And Carl Jung actually wrote back to him and talked about how the word spirit is used for alcohol, mm-hmm. and that we're really using the wrong word to tap into someone's spirit. Alcohol is not the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, like, why are so many 12-step AA programs strictly no drugs, no caffeine, they're so against a drug, using a drug, yet if their founder, Bill W., used LSD to be cured of his addiction, see, there's the conflict that, again, we're all talking about right now.
Absolutely. Yep. So it's, and again, there's no cooker cutter approach to this. Each person is an individual. They have to make an individual choice mm-hmm. for their lives. If what you're doing is working, that's great. You know, I want to encourage people to do what's working for them, but it doesn't work for everyone. And so we need to be able to address, you know, those people that the standards, you know, what they've been doing for the past year, decades, who knows how long, just isn't working, and finding another push for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get back to that part of that neuroplasticity. This is such an important issue because, you know, a lot of actually our patients come to us with past trauma that may also involve head injuries, traumatic brain injuries. I think this is going to be a very exciting area of further research, because we see when these people get treatment and they come to us with different types of cognitive issues, concentration, different speech mm-hmm. issues, memory issues, we oftentimes see improvement in aspects that involve cognition. And my opinion is that this has a lot to do with the neuroplasticity and the increased synaptogenesis. So I envision that this is going to be really a significant type of treatment, both for the pain, which we see, the depression, PTSD, but also potentially for different neurocognitive issues as well.
How's the research looking in that department?
So it's starting to show some benefit there. You know, it's very, you know, the research is pretty young, but from our clinical experience, I can see this being really an area that's going to flourish, I would say, within the next few years.
That's beautiful. I hope it does happen. I'm curious. So are all your treatments covered by insurance, like the IV infusions and everything? Good topic.
No, that's a really great question that I think a lot of people ask. And the short answer is no, actually. And the reason for that is because insurance companies will only cover a medication for its use if you use it for its specific indication that the FDA gave. Now, ketamine is FDA approved, no question asked about that. The problem is that the FDA indication for ketamine use is general anesthesia and sedation. It's not depression, anxiety, and chronic pain.
Does that vary by state?
Well, I
Because I
don't.
think in Minnesota it is approved for nasal
Oh.
spray for depression, but that's it. That's
Thank
it.
you for bringing that up. That's
Okay.
another great sideway question. So the reason why the F okay, so I'm sorry, I have to take this really far back into biochemistry.
Go for it.
So every chemical that you have in the US that comes in a vial, it's a racemic mixture. A racemic mixture basically has two different chemicals in it. And the chemicals are the exact same chemical, except for they're mirror images of each other. The best way I can try to describe this to somebody who is a non-medical person is by the hands, right? So you have your right hand and your left hand. They both have five fingers. They both have a thumb, a pointer, a middle, a ring, and a pinky, except for they're different. And they're different because of the way that the fingers are attached to the hand, the orientation of that. One is clockwise and the other one is anti-clockwise. And so this is what a racemic mixture has. It has my two hands in it, basically, which is the same chemical, except for the rotation of the atoms is attached differently to the central atom. And by convention, one of those chemicals is called the R enantiomer, and the other one is the S enantiomer, so the R and the S. So with the intranasal ketamine, that is not a racemic mixture. That is a mixture where one of the enantiomers was removed, and the one that was removed was the R, and this is why it's called S ketamine, S because they left behind the S enantiomer. And so the intranasal, so that study was sponsored by Johnson and Johnson. And so basically what Johnson and Johnson did is they modified the ketamine, the racemic mixture. They created this, in the FDA eyes, a new mixture, which is basically they just eliminated half of the molecules in there. And then they did some studies which showed that it's just as effective as the racemic mixture that we all can get. Not all of us, but physicians can get from, suppliers in the US.
Is that very common with other drugs too? They just remove one little molecule and there you go. That's it.
And this is the reason why only the intranasal is approved to be covered by insurance and only for specific indications, which is what Johnson and Johnson proved, which is I think is just depression. So you have to show that you have depression. I do not think you can use it for chronic pain and have it covered by insurance.
Can you do that for IV infusions too? Remove one molecule or something and
Yeah, I guess you could. And honestly, the reason why it hasn't been done is because there's no money in it for the pharmaceutical companies. Because the way the pharmaceutical company makes money is with something that's patented, and they can't patent ketamine. Ketamine is already generic, it's been around for 70 years. And so this is why the only way to have the FDA approve ketamine, the way that we use it through, with the racemic mixture is to have these publicly funded studies. And our clinic is part of that. We are on a platform called Ozmind, and Ozmind has over 350 clinics that they support in the United States that are ketamine clinics. And what they do is they ask us if we allow them to use our patient data, which our clinic does. And what they do is they de-identify the patients, meaning that your name is no longer Jacob in their system. It's now a big string of letters and numbers. And we ask that the patient take these little surveys. They're standardized surveys. There's 10 questions. They get it once a week. And basically, this is how we track their progress. So they basically collect this data from us, and then they can run these large studies. They're called meta-analysis studies. They're basically a pooled data set with thousands and thousands of patients where they could show, okay, look, all these people are getting IV ketamine in the racemic form, and all these people are showing, this improvement in their depression and anxiety and chronic pain. And this is the only way that we can potentially in the future force the FDA to approve this indication for ketamine.
Well, here's another thing too. Isn't it like technically a lot cheaper too to
Yeah, so
make it?
the racemic mixture is a lot cheaper because it's generic. The reason why the other mixture is expensive is because, right, Johnson and Johnson put money into making this nasal spray. They got to get the money out, so
Yeah.
they're going to price it a lot higher. This is all about economics. It has nothing to do with patient care or patient outcomes or providing a superior product. And in fact, I would argue that intranasal ketamine is inferior. It's inferior by a long shot to IV or IM, because part of it is the way that it's delivered. Now, if you squirt something in someone's nose, can you really standardize that administration every time they come in? Maybe some of it like came out of their nose.
Yeah.
Maybe they had a lot of mucus on their membranes. And when you have mucus on your membranes, the medicine cannot penetrate those mucus to get to the membrane where it actually can get absorbed. So if I come in and I have a sinus infection, or I have frequent sinusitis, or I have a lot of mucus because I'm just that kind of a person, I'm not going to be consistently getting the same dose every time I come in, because my conditions are going to be different. And two, person A and person B cannot get the same kind of dosages either, because they're different in the way that that their physiology and everything is. So this is, we have a lot of patients in our clinic who tried the intranasal first, and then they came in to do the actual intravenous, and they come on, they're like, wow, this is like world away different.
But conspiracy wise, if you were the antidepressant and anxiety medication companies, you wouldn't want ketamine to make it big. A cheaper, better option. I would hate that. I would talk so much shit about those guys, because it's all about, like, let's just keep it real, money.
Exactly. Yeah.
I would do anything in my power to interfere with. And again, that's just me and my evil thinking that I'm assuming they could maybe have.
Unfortunately, your evil thinking is right on point, and this is exactly how they think.
And so yeah, it's just like, why don't we just bring it out in the open and talk about it? If we're getting all these positive results from research regarding ketamine, I mean, how many more research studies do we need to get more approval from FDA and so forth? Like,
some of the most highest grossing pharmaceuticals are antidepressant and antipsychotic medication.
Yep.
Things such as Abilify. These are really the most expensive medications that we have, or the nasal spray Spravato. The other thing that's concerning with the nasal spray is that to qualify actually for this treatment, you also have to continue to be on your antidepressant and be on something. So they're treatment resistant already, so they have to meet that criteria, but they also have to be on an antidepressant that isn't working, right? They wouldn't be coming to treatment if it's working. So you have to continue to take a medication with potential side effects in order to qualify for a treatment. And that, in my opinion, just was not what's doing in the best interest of the patient.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever heard of the TMS machine for depression and anxiety?
Oh, have we?
Yeah. So So actually, I used to work in a clinic that offered TMS for about 2 years. Yeah. So kind of within, when I was looking at treatment for depression, I've always been open to different types of innovative treatments, things that really push the ball forward on the field. And so I certainly was interested in that as a treatment option. I haven't, honestly, I did not see the profound results that we've seen with ketamine treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've really focused on this as a treatment. Seeing something that has, that can work and can have lasting results, really, there's nothing like it.
Well, I guess the reason I'm doing some training on that right now, the reason I brought that up is because they have similar prerequisites when it comes to be eligible through insurance. You need to try at least 2 to 3 antidepressants, and they all have to not work for you, as well as talk therapy does not work for you. And then, and only then, they might think about approving you for actually doing the trial. So it's like, how many times are you going to put these people through this?
And that's if you have a good insurance.
Yes.
When I was trying to get approval for patients for TMS, some insurance companies would say 4 antidepressants. Not just that, but in addition, you also have to take 2 additive type of treatments. So that could be an antipsychotic, most likely. So we're looking at 6 different treatment trials. It would take, sometimes it would take a year to get someone qualified for this type of treatment.
I mean, oh my God, that's horrendous. And hypothetically, if someone's going through suicide ideations,
you don't have that time.
You don't. I'm trying to put it in my head. I'm like, how do I put that in good words? But there's no good. They don't have time.
Let's be honest about it. These are people's lives. You don't have time.
They're not going to make it.
They're not going to make it. We need to get people treatment fast, and we need to get treatment that works for them.
Yeah, and I don't know if insurance company was a human being. It's just like, what are you not seeing right now? I'm not a medical doctor, but I see it.
These are treatments that take time. They take a lot of expertise. They take people that are qualified and understand these powerful medicines. And so that's why the insurance companies at this point aren't covering it, because it takes time and expertise. People that are trained in it and understand it and know how to react when things don't go right.
Mm-hmm. And not just that, but Dr. Fisher, can you talk about the kind of time commitment from the patient that needs to happen for the TMS treatment? It's very intense.
Yep. So typically we're like, with TMS, you're coming in about 5 treatments a week for a total of about 25 treatments. So you have to be able to spend that time to come in to receive the treatment.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And well, another interesting thing, I'm sure they're doing this in California, but Minnesota, there's been a few clinics that are coming up that are offering TMS with ketamine therapy.
And so, again, I do think TMS has its place. I think it is a helpful treatment. And because of that, you know, we actually do work with other clinics where patients are receiving TMS and need the extra help with the ketamine. So we work with other clinics to provide that treatment. And I think that's a really exciting area to be able to provide both at the same time. Both work on neuroplasticity. That's another area that's exciting to see, is we're finding interventions that are working on neuroplasticity, both from the ketamine standpoint and the research also looking now at TMS, maybe in shorter periods of time, kind of more intensive treatments. Mm-hmm. So this is a field, I think, within medicine that's really exciting. We're also very excited about psilocybin as a treatment going through the research studies right now, as well as MDMA, assisted psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So both of those are going through the FDA process as we speak.
Are they on the last stage right now through MAPS?
They are.
Yeah. Yep.
So we just came back from a big conference in Miami, and we were able to see Rick Doblin speak about this.
Oh, wow.
This is a really exciting area.
So
part of that thing that is interesting too, that is similar between the ketamine treatments, MDMA treatments, and also psilocybin, is something that we haven't talked about very much, is music.
Mm-hmm.
And the role that music can play in these types of treatments. Our patients describe the music as integral to their experience. It really affects their journey and their ability to process through different emotions and things that come up. I like to describe the music that I play. I curate all the music. I almost think of myself as a DJ psychiatrist.
Yep. Nice. I love it.
So I really curate, get them on a, you know, an upwards journey with a particular song, get them kind of on the cruising journey with different patterns, different structure to the sound.
Do they give you like a thumbs up if they like it?
A lot of times they do, where they will actually talk to me afterwards and say, you know, that song that had that particular instrument in it, can you tell me about that artist?
Nice.
I want to listen to this between my sessions. So I will actually prescribe to them, you know, this is a Spotify playlist, or this is a playlist I would like you to listen to between now and your next session. Give you some, you know, bring back that experience, bring back those different types of emotions that we're able to tap into. So I describe the music as is almost like a river. It affects the journey in your mind, your consciousness.
True.
Is a boat, and you're able to travel to different aspects. There's going to be parts that are going to be fast. There's going to be parts that are going to be rapids or more challenging. There's going to be more calm and still waters. But having that range of experience allows people to process it through different things and tap into their subconscious mind.
It's a beautiful thing. It really is. So is there anything else you want to talk about at Propel Therapeutics? Anything that we missed that you want to discuss?
Kind of, I think part of it I was starting to talk about is our future of what we see with our clinic. We are going to be looking at expanding our services. That may look like different things. One of the things we're looking at right now is retreats and be able to offer things within a retreat setting. We are also going to be having group sessions, group ketamine administration session with intramuscular and guided with one of our very experienced guides. That's going to be starting up very soon. And then we're also going to be looking at other types of products. Dr. Piva might want to talk a little bit about that.
So, you know, in order to promote a whole body wellness, you know, obviously ketamine is just a small component of improving your wellness and mental health. But of course, taking some more natural approach to your health, like encouraging, you know, clean eating, and also using some of the other things in nature that we haven't really thought about. But one thing is a functional mushrooms. Functional mushrooms have a lot of chemicals that we don't understand very well right now, but can be very helpful for many different aspects of our health. So I'm actually working with a company down in Los Angeles that we met through one of these conferences that we went to, and they have a very good product. It's an organic vegan mushroom mix from five functional mushrooms. Wow. And we are going to be offering that through our clinic, and also I will be trying to offer it to other coffee shops and other health and supplement shops in the area. In addition to that, again, of course, the ketamine retreats, we're speaking with another company that's currently in Europe that is interested in perhaps doing a kind of a joint venture with us here in California, because, you know, California is a very nice place to have these kind of things because we have a lot of nature. We have a very nice weather most of the year. And so we're basically here. We have a team. We just need a little bit more support and to get that going. But yeah, those are some of the things we're looking at. In addition to that, I will be providing some bioidentical hormone therapy, which is another aspect that is very, I guess, a little murky right now in people's heads. But a lot of the times when our hormones are not balanced in our bodies, this could also lead to a lot of the symptoms of depression, like low energy states, irritability, loss of sleep, weight gain. So really attacking that part of our physiology can be important, as well as providing these other chemicals called peptides. Peptides are naturally occurring, basically, molecules in our bodies. Peptides make up proteins. Proteins are enzymes. Yep. And proteins and peptides are kind of like this big umbrella term. But there are some specific ones that we know about that can help with healing faster. So if you are an athlete and you need to really heal fast from your injuries, from muscle tears, from, you know, ligament stretching, things like that, then yeah, those things can help. But there's other fun ones. For example, there's a peptide that can help you be more tan. This peptide basically tells the melanocytes in your body to produce more melanin. And so if you get that that peptide injected, then basically you can be tanned year round and you don't have to go in the sun or, you know, take that risk with a tanning bed. And it also helps protect you from cancers and sun damage, because, you know, that's what the melanin does. It actually covers the nucleus of the cell. It protects that nucleus, you know, where the DNA is. It protects that from the damage of the sun rays. So a lot of fun, that's interesting ways for us to really play around with the receptors of our bodies. So that's the other thing we're bringing. Yeah, I mean, it's all very exciting and new, but I think that we need to go back to kind of like this ancient medicine a little bit, where we use what our planet kind of provides us and tap into it, versus just stuffing ourselves with all these pills that the pharmaceuticals make, because, you know, those pills, they are still taken from nature. A lot of those medicines that we have now, they come from the Amazon, but really they go to these Amazon tribes and they ask them what kind of herbs and plants they use in order to improve this and that. And then what they do is they take that plant, they remove every other single chemical in it that might actually be part of why it works so well. And then they distill it down to one little chemical, which then they can patent. So now they can make all this money and then they make it into a pill. But I think we need to go back to something a little bit more natural in order to, you know, improve and really move forward with the aging process of us as humans, because I think that we're kind of plateaued in that.
Yeah.
And I know this kind of off topic, aging and everything, but I think in the US, you know, we are actually behind because our average age is actually declining.
Really?
Compared to Europe, compared to Asia, our average lifespan is declining. And a part of the reason for that is because we eat very poorly here, and we eat a lot of processed things, and also we eat a lot of things that cause a lot of fat retention in our bodies. And actually fat is really bad for us because it has these hormones in it and enzymes that actually cause the chemicals in our bodies or some of our hormones to become more active hormones that are more oxidative. And oxidative damage is bad. That's what basically ages you. That's what causes mutations. And that's what end up being cancers.
So, that also affects a person's ability to handle trauma, anxiety, not to get too far off the conversation. Yeah. Is just the exercise, sleep, nutrition really, again, helps, again, with those traumatic emotions.
Yeah. We really underestimate the power of getting sunlight, getting a good night's sleep, and eating a healthy diet. And those things have been overlooked because the industries here really push for, oh, just take this supplement, just take this medicine.
It's easier.
Yeah, it's easy to just take a weight loss pill than just like actually eat good stuff.
Yeah.
And that really gets back to something that we talk to all our patients about, is that our treatment is a catalyst. This is a way, an opportunity for us to start to make changes within our life and our lifestyles. So all those parts are so important to see that improvement happen.
It's funny, on Facebook, I had this random woman message me because she knows I do a podcast, and she's talking about MDMA, and she was so distraught and depressed. She's like, oh my God, like, what do I do? I tried MDMA and it didn't work. And it's like, I'm not a doctor. You're just messaging me on Facebook. Like, I don't... I can't give you any advice. I'm sorry your MDMA didn't work for you, but try something else. I don't know.
Did she come to California?
Yeah.
Well, did she have it in a therapeutic zone where people knew what they were doing?
Oh, good question. You know, I was too worried about giving any type of advice and get sued. So I just said, I empathize with her. Talk to your doctor. Talk to your doctor.
That's a great way to approach it, I think.
But you're right, though, because people have struggled through trauma and depression for so long. They tried this and that. When they hear things like ketamine or MDMA helping so many people, they put like all their eggs in that basket, and when it doesn't work in the way they want it to, then that's when that depression occurs again.
Yeah. And you know, we want to be really honest with the audience that ketamine is not a panacea. There are people who are considered non-responders, and that's usually about 20% of the patients that come through, which it seems like a big number, but when you compare it to the standard treatment, which is the antidepressants, it actually is a lot better. The antidepressants are about 50%, and we can improve people, you know, 80% of the time. And not just that, but we take the group of people who are already resistant to the medication, so that's the 50% that isn't getting better with the standard treatment, and 80% of those will get better. So actually, I think ketamine does really well in the big picture. But again, it's not 100%. And I don't think anything is 100%. And I think telling that to patients is really misguiding and misleading.
Well, again, it was such an honor having both of you on the show. I greatly appreciate it. I had so much fun. I know my listeners did. Now, if any of my listeners want to get a hold of you two, are there particular emails, websites they could use to send you a message?
Yeah, of course. They can always find us on our website, and that is www.propeltherapeutics.com. You can just even Google search us, Ketamine Sacramento, and through our website, you can send us a message, or you can call our number on our website or send a text message there. We're happy to field questions, or, you know, we do over the phone free consults for patients that are interested. And yeah, and again, thank you for having us on this podcast. I think you asked some very insightful and very sensitive questions that I think are very important and need to be addressed. And so I'm really glad that you did, so we can kind of spread the word and kind of get people to really understand what is going on, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. So it really helps to have, you know, podcasts like this where people can actually listen to experts and, you know, understand the way this medicine works and basically the concept of it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Such a pleasure being on this podcast with you, Jacob. And I love what you're doing, and I just want you to continue the good work.
Thank you. You guys were just amazing and awesome, and I hope to work with you in the near future again.
We love that.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I just want to thank Dr. Christopher Fisher and Dr. Sophia Piva for being amazing special guests on the show. They did a wonderful job. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called CalmeGo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale, to again help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.